On May 6th, the coronation of King Charles III took place in Westminster Abbey in London, making him officially the head of state of the United Kingdom, the head of the Church of England, as well as the UK's armed forces. He also became head of nation of several other countries, including Canada and Australia. More than half of British citizens seem to approve of the monarchy and the pomp and pageantry that goes with it, if we believe the polls. But can a monarch ever really have democratic legitimacy? Does the monarchy perpetuate an outdated and unjust social hierarchy in British society? And even though today the role is meant to be merely ceremonial, is it really possible for the monarch to be politically neutral? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I welcome to the podcast Alex O'Connor. He is the host of the YouTube channel Cosmic Skeptic, with over 500,000 subscribers, which is dedicated to the publication of philosophical debates in an accessible format. He is also an international public speaker and debater, having debated ethics, religion, and politics with a number of high-profile opponents before college audiences on radio, as well as on national television. Alex published a video essay soon after the death of Queen Elizabeth entitled Abolish the Monarchy, which caught my attention, and went recently head-to-head with the infamous Piers Morgan over why most young people today would prefer an elected head of state rather than a hereditary monarch. So Alex O'Connor of The Cosmic Skeptic, welcome to The Philosopher and the News.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you again.
Did you watch any of the coronation of King Charles over the weekend?
You know, I saw a couple of clips on Twitter. Couldn't be avoided. I opened the Times this morning, and there were something like 8 or 9 news stories about the coronation before you'd even swiped across to the coronation section, because they have a sort of coronation tab at the moment. And before you even get there, I couldn't escape his face. So I've seen, you know, a couple of clips and images, but I didn't watch it live, and I didn't tape it either, I will say.
It wasn't quite as mad as the media frenzy when the Queen died, as you mentioned in one of the videos you recorded soon after that the country went into some kind of like hysterical mode after the Queen died, and particularly the media, right? There was like days of non-stop coverage on the BBC and all the rest of it.
Yes, and most of it probably fake. I mean, I don't like to speak ill of people who are mourning, but I do find it quite difficult to believe that the newsreader sort of wiping the tear from their eye, that they really would feel that strongly about a woman that they've never met, as well as the fact that just by sort of the laws of statistics, I think that the amount of people professing to care deeply about the passing of the Queen can't be in line with who actually shared that feeling, especially when half of when I say sort of persons, I'm speaking in the legal sense, because a lot of the time it was a corporation, it would be Ladbrokes,
right. Yeah.
Or it would be, I saw sort of Anne Summers, as I said in this video, they had their sort of tribute to the death of the Queen just above their dildo collection on their website. And I just sort of struggle to see the sincerity in a gesture like that. And I feel like it's mostly people doing what they think they're supposed to do. I can't remember who said that propaganda is not controlling what you think, but controlling what you think other people think. And something like that was going on, I believe, with the death of the Queen, and probably is similarly happening with the coronation. But at least with the coronation, we can say this is something about tradition. This is something about people sort of care about the monarchy as an institution in a way that doesn't have the kind of personal element of people wailing in the streets over the death of the Queen.
Yeah, bizarre phenomenon that was. Maybe we'll come back to it. Let me start with this thing that I've watched sort of clips of it as well. Didn't watch the whole thing. But the thing that struck me the most for the little I watched was that this was like a deeply religious ceremony, right? And perhaps it was naive of me to be surprised by that or shocked by that, because obviously the monarchy does supposedly draw its legitimacy and power from God, this particular kind of Christian Anglican God, though there were priests from other Christian churches that took place in the ceremony. So I guess my question is this, like, I mean, the monarchy is by definition a non-democratic institution, right? But do you think there's a sort of especially non-democratic element to it when the head of state in such a religiously diverse and increasingly atheist society is granted their status by a specific Christian God?
Well, certainly. I'm not sure if it makes much of a difference in terms of the democratic legitimacy of the monarchy. I mean, it's interesting. I've heard so many people say recently, they sort of refer to polls about public support for the monarchy. They say, well, I know you're a Republican, Alex, but don't you know that more than 50% of people are in favor of keeping the monarchy? And I think, well, that's great. If that's the case, why don't we make it official? How about we do some kind of poll of the electorate? I don't know. And maybe if they want to keep Charles as head of state, then we keep him. And if they don't, they don't. Wouldn't that be a novel idea if you're so confident? I mean, the sort of irony, the irony of trying to legitimize what you quite rightly point out is an undemocratic institution by definition, by reference to public support, I find it quite laughable. But of course, it's made all the more ridiculous when you consider the fact that the authority, if it doesn't come from the people, it must come from somewhere, and officially it still comes from the authority of God. And like you say, we're a sort of increasingly atheist, and even if not atheist, certainly secular society. But I don't think it matters that much, in that I don't think people in this country take Christianity, and certainly not Anglicanism, particularly seriously. I don't think it massively bothers anybody that the head of state is the wrong religion, if they feel they're the wrong religion, because of the fact that Christianity is a little bit lukewarm in this country. So I don't think it's actually that bad. I do think it sort of adds some of the necessary mystique. Mystery is one of the sort of most important parts of an institution like the monarchy and ceremonies like the coronation, which is why, of course, they had to put up these barriers when the actual anointing took place, which is one of the, let's say, most religious parts of the ceremony. It sort of harkens back to Old Testament anointing of kings of Israel. And they still now, despite being willing to show the rest of it in HD on television, will put them behind a curtain. And I think they'll say this is because it's the most sacred part and the most private part of the ceremony, but it also might be because if they didn't cover it up, then everybody would be able to see what's actually happening, which is one Homo sapiens rubbing chrism oil onto the body of another and pretending as if this endows them with some supernatural authority to rule over the rest of us. The moment they took the curtain away, it would simultaneously, I think, take away any legitimacy in the minds of the people, which it already does. I mean, people watching this, I think, are quite moved by the ridiculousness of it all. I mean, Charles himself, if some people have commented, looked a little bit weird, looked a bit almost sad, uncomfortable, and you know, some people say it's because he's considering the weight of becoming the next monarch, but I have a feeling it might be because he felt a bit naked. He probably was very aware of himself in this ridiculous robe, holding this orb and this sword or whatever the hell it was he was carrying around. I don't think there's a way that you can do that in the 21st century, put it on television in high definition for everybody to watch and not feel a little bit silly.
I mean, I guess what you're pointing out is that there's a lot of ceremony and ritual involved in all of this. And, you know, it's kind of like one of the essential features in some ways of the royal family. And there are people that have made the argument that the sort of secular world or our kind of like more secular society has lost a sort of sense of ritual and a sense of ceremony. And it is something that we crave as humans. We crave these kind of like slightly, maybe mysterious isn't the right word, but like moments that have this sort of aspect of ritual. I guess there's no other way of putting it. I mean, to what extent do you think that's true? And do you think that's one of the reasons why people still find kind of the whole thing a bit fascinating? And it's one of the institutions with the more kind of historical ties to all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, humans are ritualistic, of course. And I don't mean to speak as if I'm sort of above being human. I understand it, which is why I wouldn't necessarily want to do away with the ceremony and the pomp and pageantry, which seem to be the two words of the week. I've been hearing them more than I've been hearing my own name, it seems, in the past couple of days. Fine. If we want that, then we can keep that. I mean, the French do it pretty well. I don't know if you've ever seen a inauguration of a US president. It's still pretty ceremonial. It's still a pretty big affair. It's still pretty traditional, indeed. And there's no reason why we can't be doing this kind of thing without removing what most people now think, I believe, if they really sort of sat and reflected on it, is an illegitimate form of political power. I mean, people console themselves in the fact that they don't really have any political power, in which case I would say there's not much point in keeping them around. And when we hear about the public support for the monarchy and we hear that you know, republicanism is still a fairly small cause, I have a feeling that's because, at least in part, it hasn't really been put on the agenda. I mean, people have spoken about it for a very long time, but I think most of the people, if you ask in the street and say, what do you think of the monarchy? And they say, oh, yeah, you know, it's great. You know, King Charles, it's part of our country tradition. If it became a real national issue and people were forced to actually reflect for a while on whether they think this is a good thing to keep, I expect that you would see the support for republicanism increase by quite a lot. I don't know if it would become a majority. That's difficult to say. But I think that part of the reason people, so to speak, support the monarchy is just because it's just something that's always been there that hasn't really been on the agenda. I think the moment it's put there.
Why do you think that is?
We might see that change.
Why do you think there is no sort of political momentum behind republicanism in this country? You mentioned these polls. I mean, a lot of polls show, yeah, just about over half the country is pro-monarchy. An increasing number of people are kind of indifferent to the whole thing. And it's about sort of 20% or less that are kind of explicitly Republicans that are for the abolition of the monarchy. So why do you think this is an issue that has basically no political representation at the moment? I mean, Labour wouldn't dare, for example, kind of challenge this. I mean, you can't imagine Keir Starmer coming up and being, although it is a position that he did hold in the past, but now as a leader of the opposition, I mean, it would be
as indeed did our suicide. Former, our former Prime Minister. Liz Truss herself sort of famously said, I think it's
in her Liberal Democrat
back when she was a Liberal Democrat, and sort of screaming about the abolition of the monarchy, which again they wouldn't dare do today. But why is that? Is that because they'd receive significant backlash from their voters? No, I don't think so. I think it's because it's just not worth the hassle. I mean, I think that genuinely the reason why I don't think republicanism in this country has a particularly strong political current is because of the fact that it just doesn't matter that much. People don't really care. I mean, I've only spoken about the monarchy on two occasions. The first is after the passing of the Queen, when I couldn't go anywhere without seeing her face and being almost expected to, if not be respectful of her death, be sort of respectful of the fact that everybody and their dog was mourning for this woman that they'd never met. I found it a bit bizarre and I made a video to that effect. And I was also asked to talk about the monarchy when the coronation came up, I assume off the back of that video. And that's all I've had to say on the matter. Frankly, I don't actually care that much. Like, on principle, I think it's a bad idea, you know, hereditary political office. But like, there are lots of things that I care about on principle vaguely that, yeah, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. And I think the monarchy is the same. Like, ask the question, and I think it's quite clear that on a moment's reflection, it's a bit of a weird institution. It's a bit ridiculous and a bit silly. When people sort of make a really big stand out of it, as if this is like tyranny, I can't really take that particularly seriously. I don't think it matters. So I think that even if you were able to convince people that the monarchy was an illegitimate institution, to get people enthused to sort of do something about it would be so much harder, because people would probably say, yeah, you know, the monarchy's not great, but who cares? You know, they're not really getting in the way of anything except the occasional ceremony that sort of shuts down the roads in London. So I think it's just because people don't really care that much. I mean, that's one of the other things that's been shown in the polls. Some 70 or 80% of young people in this country don't care about the monarchy. You ask them about their support, and yeah, that's, you know, 52% or something are sort of in favor of keeping it. But if you ask if they actually care about the monarchy at all. The vast majority say no. They're just not bothered.
Do you think that's a mistake? I mean, I have the same kind of instinct that, yeah, I'm my kind of instincts are to be against the institution. I think, especially in the 21st century, it seems out of place. And you know, I became a naturalized British citizen a few years ago, and I had to swear allegiance to the Queen and all her heirs in becoming a British citizen. I found that pretty sort of embarrassing and bizarre. I didn't feel like that was the essence of becoming a British citizen, that I was now becoming a subject of the Queen and had to swear my allegiance to her. But do you think we're mistaken to think that, oh, well, it's just a bit of pageantry, a bit of this, a bit of that? And do you think in some ways the very existence of the royal family kind of perpetuates this aristocracy that undermines democracy, not in a kind of political sense, but in a kind of social sense? It makes the rest of us kind of immediately feel lesser or be lesser in this kind of like social hierarchy or you know, whatever, of class in Britain.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, that we've probably got a lot of treason on our hands, in that I presume that the vast majority of people who are supposed to swear allegiance to the Queen, whether it's because they sign up for the army or because they're becoming a British citizen or whatever it may be, probably in their heart of hearts don't care that much and wouldn't actually follow King Charles wherever he led them. So what we've essentially got is a bunch of people lying on their forms about what they're pledging allegiance to. I think that the Queen in that case, or now the King, serves the role of, you know, representation of the country. It's like how Americans are expected to pledge allegiance to the flag. You know, you're not pledging allegiance to a piece of fabric, but rather to the idea of the American experiment. And that's what the monarchy is sort of supposed to provide here. But like you say, it also provides a reminder of our position as subjects rather than citizens. And once you're not talking about the political aspect, the idea of these people being the head of state or in charge of the military or the church, sure, you can say that, you know, it's a bit of a dodgy thing anyway on the grounds of aristocracy, but then you've got a much wider problem of just class and money in general. Mm-hmm. The existence of people who have inordinate amounts of wealth who arguably don't seem to sort of deserve it, at least not in the sense that they've worked for it and sort of have it by birthright. It sort of makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but I think it's a bit more difficult to make some sort of flat argument that this is a terrible thing that needs to be eradicated from society, right? It's a little bit more complicated than that. But when it comes to official titles, when it comes to being head of the government, and certainly when it comes to being exempt from a number of taxes and also other kinds of law and lawsuits and this kind of thing, then I think yes. And also, if we must have something like a royal family, even if they are even if we rid them of their political power, the little that they do have, I think we should also rid them of the titles, of the insistence on referring to them as Majesty and Highness. I think this is very strange, and I think that does what you say. I found it so strange. One thing I did see was the concert that they put on at Windsor Castle after the coronation, and they had, you know, Lionel Richie and I think Take That, because most, I think a lot of artists turned it down, right? Because they were sort of busy or I guess maybe didn't want to do it. And I remember, like, throughout, you know, you had Kermit the Frog make an appearance and Winnie the Pooh and all these characters, and they were saying His Majesty, you know? Oh, did you know that His Majesty does this? His Majesty. And I just thought, isn't it a bit embarrassing to sit there and hear these people refer to you as Majesty? It feels a bit like, I've never traveled on a plane in anything other than economy, but I'm told that if you go like first class on an aeroplane, you walk onto the plane and you have all these stewardesses and stewards sort of saying, oh, welcome, sir, you know, come this way, let us make you as comfortable as you can. Can I get you anything? And I think to myself, I'd feel so uncomfortable because I know that they don't really think that. They don't think I'm this amazing, wonderful person that they live to serve. They're just doing it for a paycheck. And similarly, I think if I were the king, There's no way that I could take seriously people like actually referring to me as Majesty and Highness. And there are rules about this. You know, the first time you speak to the king, you say, Your Royal Highness. After that, it's Sir. Like, it just is weird. It's so strange. And when I said this to Piers Morgan, he said, well, I have a problem with calling, you know, Boris Johnson the Right Honourable. Right. And I think, well, maybe, but calling someone honourable, I think, is different from calling them Highness, which, as I've also pointed out, is a relative term. It's higher than something, and that is than us. And also, you know, at least Boris Johnson is elected into that office. You know, it seems very strange to me. And I think that does, like you say, it might be troublesome enough to think, here's this family that are just born with a bunch of wealth and property and sort of waltz around as if they own the place, because in many instances, I guess they do. Even if we got rid of that, I think the added insult is it's not just, look, we've got all this money and we're here to serve and we're going to sort of do our duty. It's no, we've got all this money and we're born with it and we have all this power, and you're going to recognize that by calling us Highness and Majesty. And it's not just, you know, my fans who are doing this. It's not just the adoring crowds, but also news broadcasters and Paddington Bear. I don't know. I struggle to take it seriously more than anything.
Should we look a little bit at the sort of like arguments against abolishing the monarchy that people bring up when one argues about the sort of absurdity of the institution or the illegitimacy of it and so on? So one of the main arguments that I hear people make, and I must say something that I have entertained in the past, you know, when thinking about the kind of limits of democracy, I've thought, well, you know, there's some benefits to it. There's this kind of sense of stability, a sense of continuation. It's beyond petty party politics. They serve this sort of like sense of national unity. And if it was, if it did become an elected office, you know, who would be able to fulfill those roles? What do you make of that kind of argument?
Well, to say that the royal family is above petty politics or petty argument. I mean, maybe politics technically, but you know, when I see headline stories about affairs and about betrayal and this Harry and Meghan nonsense, that I'm still not entirely sure what that's all about. And I think to myself, really? Like, we're talking about, you know, this institution that's supposed to be above it all, a bit untouchable and providing stability, and what we really have is a family that's essentially falling apart and doing it on the world stage. I'm not sure it provides the unity that people think it does. We've also just had the longest reigning monarch in UK history, and so of course we're going to have a sense of stability because there's been one woman at the helm. But I'm told that the reason that she's so respected as a monarch and considered one of the best that we've had is because she basically didn't do anything. Now I think that says a lot already about what the monarchy does in this country. But fine, what people forget is that it's not guaranteed that we're going to have a monarch like that. We don't know what Charles is going to do. We don't know how he's going to try and meddle in politics. He may not. But if he does, there's nothing we can do about it. Like the stability of sort of the quiet feminine hand of the queen becomes this sort of meddling, interfering man who wants to, you know, push his political courses. Now, I'm not saying that he's going to do that. But if he does, what are we going to do about it? You know what I mean? And, you know, Charles, I don't know how long he's really got on the throne. You know, not to be rude, but he is getting on a bit. I mean, there's some arguments to suggest maybe they should just sort of leave up all of the coronation stands and just wait for the next one and save a bit of taxpayer money. I don't know. I don't know if it provides the stability that people are looking for. And even so, it becomes what is it about them that's unifying the country? Is it that we've got sort of a bunch of people who look at this family or this person and say, this is something that's sort of distinctly British, that remains vaguely the same, that's apolitical, and that most people can just sort of get together and celebrate with their family? Well, like, you know, so is the World Cup, or so is, like I say, Paddington Bear or something of this sort.
It's a bit almost like a democratic argument that it's a sort of representation, that the Queen or the Crown kind of represents the country in a way that goes beyond the way that a Prime Minister represents the country, because the Prime Minister has always been elected by a very, you know, small fraction or fraction in any case of the country. So yeah, I guess that's
And when you I mean when you have like sort of 50% of young people, at least, not being in favor of even keeping the monarchy around, I don't know if this is unifying as people like to claim. I think if there were some competition, if people thought there were a chance that rather than Charles, we could have somebody else on the throne, you'd see a little bit more debate. You'd see a little bit more criticism of Charles as a political leader. You'd probably see him trying to be a better monarch, whatever that would look like, whether that means interfering more, interfering less. You'd begin to see a bit of sort of politics going on. So like, of course, when we have an unelected head of state, there isn't going to be the same kind of political drama revolving around them. But then that might as well be an argument for not electing our head of government either. I mean, everybody hates petty politics. We despise seeing all these scandals in the newspaper. Why not let's just say that from now on, Rishi Sunak just starts a dynasty and his children can become, you know, the next leaders of the government when he dies. Wouldn't that solve all our problems? Well, maybe in one respect, but I don't think it can be taken seriously in the other. I mean, the difference is, of course, the monarchy doesn't have any political power. But then what is it about them that's supposed to be representative or unifying to the country? You know, I don't see it. I know that like a few of my sort of older relatives probably look at the king and think, yeah, you know, that's the king, that's Britain and whatnot. But it's not like in times of national crisis. It's not like when everyone was arguing about Brexit or during the COVID pandemic that I'd get together with my friends of my age and say, well, you know, God save the Queen at least. It's ludicrous to suggest that she actually serves as much of a significant role in that respect as people like Piers Morgan would like to think. I just don't think people care that much.
So one of the things you mentioned there in your response was that the royal family doesn't really have any real political power. And that's often an argument, again, by the defenders of the monarchy, right? The idea is that this is a merely a ceremonial institution. There's no real political power. The monarch is politically neutral. This just adds some kind of gravitas to our otherwise kind of rather mundane constitutional setup. What do we make of that?
I don't know what it is that people think that they bring to this country. And certainly anything more than they could bring if we sort of divest them of their power. If we quit with the tax breaks, quit with the titles, quit with the sort of state-funded ceremonies, allow them to be this sort of important celebrity family that somehow represents the country in every way that they do today, except they're subject to taxation. And we don't pay for them, and they don't get to, you know, they can have lunch with the Prime Minister every week if they want, but they can't do it as a matter of sort of right. Stop asking them permission to form a government, this kind of thing. I'm not quite sure what we'd lose. People are still probably about the same amount of people would show up to see, you know, the funeral of Charles or William after the official abolition of the monarchy as would do if they hadn't. If it didn't get abolished. I don't think it would actually make a huge difference. If they still want to get married in Westminster Abbey, they can do so. And if they still want to line the streets, then fine. And, you know, if it requires the taxpayer to fund the security operation, then fine, I'm okay with that. I think that, you know, if people are interested in doing something in a public gathering, then yes, you know, we should be funding the security operation. But we shouldn't be funding the ceremony. We should be funding the decorations. And just by taking that part away, I'm not sure what we'd lose.
Yeah, that was one of the arguments you had with Piers Morgan when you said, well, I wouldn't like this ceremony to be done on, you know, the taxpayers' dime. And Morgan said, well, they bring in more money than they cost us. They basically pay for themselves through tourism and things like that, which to begin with, I'm not sure how exactly you can establish that fact that how many people wouldn't have come to the UK had it not been for the royal family.
That's right. And it's not like, I mean, there are so many things to say about this. It's not like people would stop visiting the United Kingdom if we removed the monarchy. I mean, the money that's being counted as the monarchy bringing in tourism revenue will be things like visits to Windsor Castle and Buckingham Palace, which I'm sure people would still do without the existence of an unelected head of state. I spoke to a friend this weekend, and I said to him, "Look, are you in London? Are you going to see any of this coronation stuff? Are you going down?" And he said, "Oh no, sorry, I'm actually in France at the moment. I went on holiday for the bank holiday weekend." And I said, "It's amazing that France still has tourists like you going to visit when they don't have an unelected head of state. I don't know how they do it." the Palace of Versailles does just fine. And that is to say that, like, if we removed the royal family from these palaces, or not even removed them from the palaces, but, you know, subject them to taxation, people would still visit. And that's sort of one argument. The second argument to say is that, as I say, the money that's being counted, like you say, is very difficult to actually determine whether it's coming from the royal family or just essentially from their assets. I mean, there was one figure that was touted by the media for a long time. I can't remember the exact figure of how much they brought in per year. And the organization Republic sort of did essentially an audit of this figure and found that, for instance, they were including revenue from St. Paul's Cathedral in the amount of money that the royal family was bringing into the country from tourism for some reason. It sort of doesn't make very much sense to me at all. And, you know, I mean, I think it was estimated some over £2 billion or something was lost or is going to be lost today from the UK economy because of the extra bank holiday. So I'm not sure it balances out in the way that people would need it to for this argument to work. And even so, I don't think we should be determining who it is and what the nature of our constitution is and who our head of state is based on the economic whims of tourists. It seems like a pretty bad way to determine who the head of state is. I mean, I'm not going to vote for the next prime minister based on how many tourists are going to come to sort of see him standing outside number 10. That would be a ludicrous suggestion.
To go back to the sort of question of political power, I mean, one issue I have with the claim that they don't, you know, the monarch doesn't hold any power, they are politically neutral. So I find that hard to believe for a number of reasons, one of which is that we have evidence that they do occasionally lobby the government for specific requests, often to do with tax and tax cuts to the royal family and how they're funded and so on. But also having a meeting with the head, you know, the prime minister on a weekly basis. I mean, you know, they can't tell them what to do, obviously, but, you know, people would pay hundreds and thousands of pounds from, you know, business and other areas, and they do when they try and lobby the government to have dinner with the prime minister or dinner with whatever, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So I don't know, I kind of find it hard to buy the idea that they're sort of politically completely neutral. They don't have any political beliefs of their own, and even if they do, they somehow have no influence over how the country ends up being run.
And of course, tax breaks are in effect a disguised form of tax subsidy. If the monarch doesn't pay a single penny of inheritance tax on the multi-hundred million pound estate that he just inherited from his mother, this seems like, you know, it's a sort of vague sense in which we're talking about power. It's not quite political power, but as I say, you know, a tax break and a tax subsidy sort of merge into one thing. And legal exemptions too that they have, again, political power of a sort. Now, the Equalities Act of 2010 is designed not to apply to the monarch. It's designed so that it's impossible. If you're an employee of the king and you experience racial or sexist discrimination, it's actually impossible for you to make a complaint to the courts. There's no grounds on which you can do it because it was designed not to apply to them. Besides the point of political power, I think this is also just quite bad optics. One of the things I was talking about, the reason that I was really invited onto the Piers Morgan show, was to ask whether the monarchy is out of touch with the youth of modern Britain. Mm. And I think if there's one thing that young people really seem to care about, it's something like, you know, social justice, equality, and the optics of having a monarch who's exempt from a law designed to prevent racial and sexist discrimination, I don't think is a particularly good set of optics.
You know, the fact that this has been known as a political fact for many years, that, you know, young people start on the left wing of the spectrum, of the political spectrum, and then sort of gradually as they get older move towards the center or become increasingly conservative in any case, and eventually maybe end up voting for the conservatives. Recent data suggests that that's not happening for this generation. Do you think something similar might happen in terms of whether young people today mature, as it were, into being more supportive of the monarchy? Do you think these attitudes are going to stick in the long run?
I think it's possible. I certainly do. Because I do think that there's something about, you know, tradition, the value of tradition that's inherent to conservatism that I think perhaps takes a long time to recognize. I mean, I'm still quite young. I don't think I fully appreciate the value of long-held traditions, because even if I can understand them and I'm sort of told how long they've lasted, I haven't really lived it in the same way. I can imagine that for somebody who remembers being present at the coronation of Queen Elizabeth and the monarchy having been this constant force throughout their entire life, to see it now sort of so casually dismissed by a bunch of young people who in their view don't really know what they're talking about, I can understand why that would make them uncomfortable, and why it might be that as people grow older, they become, at the very least, maybe a bit sort of more uncaring. They think, oh, remember when we were younger and we used to think it really mattered? Yeah, who cares? Whatever. But also some people might think, oh, you know what? This tradition thing's got something going for it. That may be the case. But I think that a lot of the support for monarchy is essentially based upon sentiment. People have a sort of sentimental soft spot for monarchy in this country. Like I say, I don't mind keeping up with the tradition. I don't mind keeping up with the ceremony. I just think that the idea of having an elected head of state is quite clearly on its way out. The world is moving in one direction, it seems. And I think the UK is going to have to catch up at some point. I mean, the monarchy's been playing catch up on a lot of things for many years, as is often the nature of conservatism. You know, it won't conserve indefinitely. It will sort of put a halting force on what, you know, liberals would describe as progress, but others might just describe as change. I think it's quite clear that this change is going to happen at some point. And so I'm not sure that we're going to see a sort of shift in opinion among young people. But, you know, I don't know. It's difficult to say.
Yeah. I mean, we said earlier that the sort of monarchy is intrinsically an anti-democratic institution, and that it's somehow ridiculous to say that it's legitimized because, you know, the majority of people in a poll suggest that they are pro it. But I mean, some people do point out that the monarchy can only really exist as long as people implicitly consent to it, right? And this is, in fact, a major source of anxiety for the royal family and, from what we hear, the current king, because they need to be kind of continued to be perceived as relevant or useful to the country or somehow fulfilling some function, and that the minute that the majority of the public stop seeing them as fulfilling those roles, you know, that will be kind of the end of them. So this is a slightly bizarre kind of argument that, you know, ultimately the monarchy does have democratic accountability, but just not in a kind of direct way. What do you think of that? Do you think there's an element of truth to this?
Perhaps, but of course, I think that generally speaking, political leadership should not be based on so much people not having that much of an objection, but rather sort of affirmative consent. The idea of democratic institutions is that we're supposed to be continually allowing people to say what it is that they want to be the case. If the monarchy only survives because people sort of aren't really paying that much attention and don't actually care that much, and sort of a beginning to realize that maybe it's not a great idea, and it just doesn't seem like a very strong reason to keep it around. Like you say, there's a sense in which if people really wanted to get rid of it, then it couldn't survive. I'm not quite sure what that would look like. I think if everybody woke up tomorrow and sort of hated the monarchy, it's not like you can just sort of vote them out of the ballot box. There'd need to be some kind of protest. You'd need to get MPs on board. And I think that even if the majority of the country were in favor of abolishing the monarchy, because of the sort of ties that MPs have and because of the influence that aristocracy still has over the politics of this country, I think it'd be difficult to see it immediately enshrined into law. It would probably eventually happen, but it would be a bit slower. It would be delayed. It would take some time. I don't think it's quite as straightforward as saying that if everybody woke up tomorrow and decided they didn't want a monarchy anymore, it would disappear. Because the monarchy doesn't have that much power, it wouldn't be like violent revolution. People wouldn't sort of take to the streets with their pitchforks and demand the head of the king, because people don't care that much. They probably just say, yeah, you know what, I could see with getting rid of this, but it's probably not going to happen, so who cares? You know, let's just get on with things. People have got more important things to worry about. You know, they want to pay their bills and feed their children. People don't really care about who's the head of state unless the head of state is actually doing something of political importance.
Although from what we've seen, both when the Queen died and now in the coronation, the state, the government, or maybe the police are very, very nervous about any sort of demonstration that challenges the legitimacy of the monarchy. I mean, we saw some really absurd things happen after the Queen died. Completely peaceful protesters just holding banners being arrested. It was a case of that one barrister who was trying to make a point by holding a completely blank canvas as a form of protest. And there was an issue of whether he was going to get charged. And now the coronation, we saw people getting preemptively arrested before they'd even, demonstrated, essentially having their signs confiscated. What do you think that tells us? I mean, there's a sort of, the police said explicitly there was a sort of lower bar for arresting people for protesting during the coronation. What does this show us? Does this show that maybe the monarchy does have more political power than, again, we give them credit, that once the challenge in the form of protest comes along, the hand of the state comes down pretty hard?
Of course, the kind of protests that you see at something like a coronation are not of serious importance. It's not the kind of thing that's actually going to signal change and convert people to republicanism. It's basically just disruptive behavior, which is what protests are often supposed to do. I mean, you had some Just Stop Oil people who were arrested, and I think the fear was they were going to try and sort of glue themselves to the road or something, which, it's difficult to justify preemptively arresting somebody for doing that, but you can sort of understand the breach of the peace and concerns, especially when I think the police were probably incredibly nervous of all the different things that could have gone wrong. You have people who want to glue themselves to the road. You have anti-monarchy campaigners who want to, boo the king. But you also probably have some quite severe terrorist threats, and you've got to be really on the lookout. Like, there's probably a lot to contend with. And so I understand why, just as a matter of practice, they just have to be very sort of low tolerance. I'm not sure if that's intrinsic to the monarchy or just because it's such a big event that drew such different criticisms from such different areas and walks of life. I think it's got more to do with that than it has to do with sort of the monarchy having political power. We probably would see a similar kind of thing at the Olympics or something. If there was significant fear that there were going to be these kinds of protests, I think the police would probably be a bit more on guard than usual. That's not to say that there's, sort of an illegitimate extra power there. I do think it's weird that apparently the police in Trafalgar Square had erected sort of barriers in front of the Republican protests. At least Peter Tatchell claims this happened because they wanted to prevent the king from seeing the protests when the carriage went by. So there were these huge sort of barriers in the way of seeing the protests. Now, I wasn't there, and I haven't really been able to sort of look in detail at what happened, but people who were there, at least Peter Tatchell, did claim that that's what was happening. Graham Smith, the CEO of Republic, was arrested, I think, before even making it to the protest. A truck full of signs saying "Not My King" was taken over by the police, and they say that they found sort of, I don't know, some zip ties or something in there, which they feared people were going to use to tie themselves to monuments or something like that. But that wasn't the plan of Republic at all. They probably had a few things to fasten up the signs. The fact that Graham Smith could be, I believe, again, preemptively arrested, because I don't think he actually made it to the protest, and held for some 16 hours because he wanted to hold up a sign shouting "Not My King" is troubling. But I would be wary to say that this is because it's the monarchy. It might just be because it was such a unusually large spectacle in the center of London.
So in some ways, this is a discussion about tradition and custom. And some people look at Western philosophy as starting with Socrates, or at least one of its originators, who made it his express goal to kind of challenge the customary beliefs and maybe even practices of ancient Athenians. And his point was to expose, people's beliefs as kind of muddled, as contradictory, more or less to show that they were irrational. So do you think that philosophy has any particular role to play in kind of turning people from sort of a mild indifference or soft monarchist to republicans? Is there any text that you would recommend for challenging the validity of the monarchy as a political institution?
Well, I think it's sort of political philosophy, right? And the idea of political philosophy is a bit vague because you can have a philosophy of anything. You know, you have sort of philosophy of science and philosophy of aesthetics, and political science is kind of like that. It's basically just political thought, but they slap the label philosophy on it. But I think that, you know, throughout all of history, people have written about the monarchy. I think, for example, if you really want sort of a principled case against monarchy, you're unlikely to find it today because of the fact that the monarchy doesn't really do that much. What you are more likely to be after is criticism from a time when the monarchy was actually quite an important political force. For example, the writings of Thomas Paine might be of interest to you. Mm-hmm. If you read Common Sense and you read the case against taxation without representation, and you take a sort of similar line to thinking about your tax funds paying for the goings about of this family, again, ostensibly on the justification that they bring in more tourism than they're worth. Cheshire Zoo is a larger tourist attraction in the United Kingdom than Windsor Castle or Buckingham Palace. I wouldn't be in favor, because of that, of a state-funded ceremonial opening of the new chimpanzee exhibit. You know, I just think in practice it doesn't work. But you can sort of take all of that thought and map it on to people writing in like the 18th century, because the principle is the same, and there's a reason why it won. I heard Stephen Fry recently describe constitutional monarchy as genius. He said this is the genius of constitutional monarchy. It's sort of the monarch is for everybody and for nobody, he said. He made some point about how, you know, it's this kind of brilliant balance, as if this is some genius idea that we've thought up from scratch and not just the result of political compromise. It's the result of somebody claiming ownership and lordship over the entire United Kingdom, a bunch of rich people getting upset with that and saying we want some representation too, and being granted it, because otherwise he's probably going to be beheaded or ousted. And then a bunch of slightly less rich people saying, you know what, we want in on this as well. And then some slightly less rich people doing the same thing. And then maybe some women doing the same thing. And eventually you get to a position where the monarch has sort of retreated into this corner where they say, okay, just don't come any closer. You know, I'll just sit here in my corner in silence and I'll let you get on with you. Just please don't evict me. This is not genius political design. This is compromise.
Alex O'Connor, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Philosopher in the News. And thank you to Alex O'Connor. Do check out his YouTube channel, Cosmic Skeptic. And as always, this podcast is produced in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. It's celebrating 100 years this year, so do check out its latest issue and upcoming online events. You can go to the website, thephilosopher1923.org, and find out more, order issues, read some online articles, and check out all the events that are coming up in the calendar. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode of The Philosopher in the News, don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. The link will be in the show notes. I always appreciate hearing feedback from listeners, and it also helps others find the podcast. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.